Good afternoon, and welcome to the Tuesday, April 27th meeting of the House Education Finance Committee. Remote hearings are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them, and for the public, these same materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they're attached in the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. Ms. Sunderland, would you please take the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandsted.
Present.
Representative Cresha.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damath.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist. Representative Feist. See her on the call here. We'll come back to her. Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt, present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Richardson. She's excused, but will be joining us later. Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
Representative Feist. Representative Thompson. That is the roll, and we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderland. Representative Erickson, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from our Thursday, April 22nd meeting? And if so, would you like to move approval of those minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes. What is the date again?
Thursday, April 22nd.
Thursday, April. April what?
22nd.
22nd. I read them a while ago. Earlier today. So mm-hmm. I move approval of the minutes. From April 22nd.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any discussion to the Erickson motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Members, this committee has devoted extensive time to examining solutions that lift children out of the opportunity gap that has been created due to the racial disparities in our state systems. Today's hearing is an informational hearing on a set of solutions that are being put forward by the participants involved in the Cruz-Guzman lawsuit. This is only the beginning of our work, and no formal action will be taken today. Are there any questions from the committee before we get started? With that, I hand the virtual gavel over to Representative Sandsted. Representative Sandsted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to the committee hearing, members. I will now have Representative Dabney introduce House File 2471.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, in 2015, seven families who have had children in traditional urban, suburban, and charter schools filed a lawsuit against a number of entities, including the Commissioner of Education, the Governor, the State of Minnesota, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. The suit contended that the State of Minnesota was failing to educate students of color, and low-income students. The lawsuit has taken a series of turns over the years, including the inclusion of three charter schools as interveners and the narrowing on the state and the two houses of the legislature as sole defendants. The court-ordered mediation is a way for all parties to collaborate on a potential settlement. The mediation began in 2019 with a series of face-to-face meetings considering many different aspects of students' well-being, school experience, and academic outcomes. That included issues related to culturally competent school environments, housing, school discipline practices, integration, the impact of the impact of charter schools on school demographics, after and out of school time program availability, and other issues. The bill before us is a first draft by the department of points of agreement from the mediation between the department and the plaintiffs. It includes new proposals to increase integration in schools, creates mechanisms for creating diverse charter schools, and develops a new integration plan that includes charter schools. I'll let MDE walk through a more thorough history of the lawsuit and the concepts in the bill, and then we'll hear from the plaintiffs and the charter schools who are intervening. First, however, I understand Attorney General Ellison has joined us for brief remarks.
Welcome to the committee, Attorney General Ellison. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Keith Ellison. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, and it's certainly an honor to be in before the committee today, and I want to thank you for holding this important informational hearing. So we're gathered today to consider House File 2471, which reflects the agreement between plaintiffs and the Minnesota Department of Education to resolve the Guzman litigation. The agreement resulted from a two-year mediation process in which we met, we talked, we listened, and you will hear much more about that process. Throughout the process, I've always believed that mediation offered us the greatest opportunity to obtain the best outcome, the most expeditious outcome for all school kids while terminating the complex litigation. You know, I've always found that mediation, talking it out, can be fruitful and beneficial. And in this particular situation, I think that it has been. After 2 years and thousands of collective hours of effort, we have the opportunity to achieve a significant positive result for children and avoid litigation. But it's in your hands, and that's why we're before you. As with every mediated settlement, the agreement represents a compromise resolution. Plaintiffs have settled for less than their original goals. We understand the settlement proposal may not entirely reflect the highest priorities of the House and the Senate or the department, but as you know, this settlement is designed to terminate longstanding litigation against the state. I also believe this settlement proposal is consistent with the goals of the House, Senate, and the administration. With your chosen representatives present throughout the in-person mediation sessions, including Representative Dabney, Senator Nelson, and others who joined, the state made substantial progress negotiating with the plaintiffs on achievement and integration measures that will both resolve the lawsuit and help all Minnesota children succeed. Were the mediation to fail, and it could if we can't make any progress, the matter would return to the court for litigation, beginning with an extensive discovery and ultimately a trial. Were this to occur, the legislature would lose the ability to control the outcome. It would become a judicial proceeding in which judges make decisions. Were we to try the case and the court conclude the state system of education does not provide the opportunity for all school children to obtain an adequate education, something currently unidentified in Minnesota law, the state would cede ultimate control of the education system to the courts. And I know the legislature jealously guards its power. I used to be a member of the legislature for 4 years and was very honored to be there. That's not the outcome any of us would want. Although there still would be some deference to the legislature, the final say regarding what constitutes an adequate education would be something the courts would decide. There would likely be years of back and forth litigation between the courts and the legislature, and the ball would go backwards and forwards. And, you know, no, we don't really know when this matter would be finally settled and resolved. In the meantime, students needing an education, waiting for us the adults to act in their best behalf. In addition, if the matter does not settle, House and Senate will be subject to discovery, given that the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the Senate and the House are proper parties. Members will have to sit in depositions. The bodies will be subject to potentially massive discovery requests. Members will be required to testify at trial in defense of the current educational system, which is scheduled to start July 2022 and consecutively could last for several weeks. Again, the trial is set to begin in a little more than a year, and in litigation time, that's pretty fast. There's also costs of the defense to consider. Similar litigation from 1995 had a budget of about $10 million, and it's not unreasonable to expect total cost to be similar here. Each and every party must recognize the common goal that you share is to terminate this litigation in a way that meets the needs of all concerned. I remain convinced the settlement of this matter is in the best interest of the state of Minnesota and the children of our state. We are now at a critical crossroads in the process. We will either resolve the matter through a negotiated settlement, or we will litigate and presumably try the case. I would prefer to resolve the matter without a trial. Settlement allows the parties, and that is you, to retain control over the resolution, though it requires compromise and cooperation. Litigation is arduous and costly. Most significantly, litigation leaves the ultimate resolution to the court, which undermines the critical institutional interests of the legislature in enacting educational policy. That cannot be accomplished without legislative action on House File 2471. I encourage you to consider the bill too, and not only resolve the lawsuit, but to advance educational equity and to achieve excellent results for all Minnesota school children. Now, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Members, are there any questions at this time? Okay, I am seeing no hands raised, so we will continue to move on. Next, we will be hearing from MDE, who will walk us through some of the background on this bill. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cordy, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Education. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm an Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Student Support Services at the Minnesota Department of Education. I've also been with the department leading our effort on the Cruz-Guzman litigation since its inception. I do have a set of slides that I believe Megan's going to share for us. Thank you. So move to the next slide. I'm going to briefly go through the history of this litigation as well as some background and kind of how we got to the House File 2471 that's in front of you today. So as the chair mentioned, the case was originally filed in November 2015 in Hennepin County District Court, with the parties being a certain parents of plaintiffs representing all, or I should say certain school children in the Minneapolis and St. Paul public school districts. The defendants include MDE as an agency, the commissioner of the Department of Education, the House, the Minnesota Senate, and the state of Minnesota itself. There was also mentioned the intervener defendants, which are three charter schools, Friendship Academy, Higher Ground Academy, and Paladin Academy. The court did certify the class action on behalf of the Minneapolis and St. Paul students. Go to the next slide. The case was dismissed by the Minnesota Court of Appeals in 2017, and they held that the case was not justiciable because it was a political issue that was required to be resolved by the legislature. The state Supreme Court in 2018 reinstated the case, finding that the legislature does determine a system of education, but the court determines whether or not the system is adequate under the Constitution. The court dismissed certain members, the leaders of the House and the Senate that were previously parties, but the legislature itself remained a party to the litigation. And finally, the court as it was remanded to the district court, which then ordered mediation. We commenced mediation in March of 2019. We had three goals of the mediation when we set forth. First, of course, was to resolve the lawsuit. Second was to improve educational opportunities for students in Minnesota and ultimately shape the outcome of the litigation. Over the years, we've made significant progress toward agreement between MDE and the plaintiffs, although this progress was slowed significantly by the COVID-19 pandemic. But through lots of work, both by the House and by people between the plaintiffs and MDE, we reached House File 2471. 2471 has several goals to it, but the two listed here that I'll focus on are increasing integration in Minnesota schools through inter-district choice, enhanced integration programs, and magnet schools, and increasing equity and achievement through best practices, including culturally responsive staff, programming, curriculum, and enhanced multi-factored accountability. MDE supports passage of this legislation and resolution of the litigation for some of the reasons set forth by the Attorney General. First of all, it would allow all parties to control the outcome of the case and would also avoid the time and expense of a trial. There are five main components to House File 2471, which I'll touch on briefly here and then walk through in detail section by section. But the first is creating a tiered model for identifying students using multiple factors. We currently use free and reduced price lunch eligibility as a measure of poverty in our state. We all know the flaws of using that measure in that it does not accurately capture the actual poverty that is existing on the ground for a number of different reasons. So this is an attempt based on what we've learned through the mediation and what other states and school districts are doing to attempt to create a model that uses multiple social and economic measures to identify areas of the state where students are more likely to experience challenges to success than others. The second is the culturally responsive teaching, learning, integration, and inclusion program and revenue system. This replaces the current achievement and integration program with a much broader and more responsive system of programs, which I'll go through in the more detailed walkthrough. The next piece is a voluntary metro-wide inter-district integration program. This would allow students in tiers with higher challenges to attend schools in areas with students in lower tiers and vice versa in order to promote integration across the metro area. The fourth would be the creation of a diverse magnet school program, which would establish four metro-based magnet schools that will offer specialized programming designed to attract a diverse group of students from across the metro area. And the last would be directing MDE to create an evidence-based practices repository and revamp our Minnesota report card reporting system to be more user-friendly and have more information for parents and families to make school choices. Here are the cost estimates, and I would emphasize that this is not an official fiscal note, but these are the cost estimates that were preliminarily prepared by our staff. You can see there for the tiered model, we're looking at $50,000 in the next biennium, followed by $50,000 in maintenance revenue after that. For the culturally responsive teaching, learning, and integration inclusion program, an additional $100 million per biennium on top of what is already in the budget or in the forecast for the achievement integration program. The voluntary metro-wide integration program would be an additional $5.5 million in the first biennium and $7 million in the second biennium. The diverse magnet school program would be $8.5 million in the first biennium, $20 million in the second. And for the evidence-based strategies and improved family information system, $175,000 to set up that, and then about $100,000 ongoing for maintenance. So you can see the total package there rounded to the nearest million. And with that, I will move to the more detailed walkthrough if you'd just like to follow along with the bill language itself. So starting with section one, on line 1.9 of the bill, this provides a number of different definitions for terms used throughout the bill. The one I would call your attention to is the definition of historically underserved students, which is defined as students of color, indigenous students, and students in poverty. The addition of students in poverty to this legislation expands the reach of these programs and drives some of the costs that were identified earlier. Section 2 on line 3.8 creates the tiered model to identify students. Beginning in the 2023 school year, the commissioner must develop a tiered model using census data and multiple measurements to identify areas in the state where students live in the most challenging environments. Multiple measurements must include, but are not limited to, median household income, percentage of home ownership, percentage of single-parent households, and average educational attainment of the population. The commissioner may add other economic criteria as they see fit, and the model will include 5 tiers, with tiers 1 and 2 identifying the tiers with the least challenging environments, and tiers 4 and 5 identifying areas with the most challenging environments. Homeless children must be assigned in this legislation to tier 5, regardless of where they reside. Moving on to section 3, which starts on line 3.24, this creates the culturally responsive teaching, learning, integration, and inclusion program. Subdivision 1 provides definitions. Subdivision 2 provides the program purpose, which is to improve opportunities, increase student achievement, and reduce disparities for historically underserved students. Subdivision 3, which starts on line 4.1, outlines which districts and charter schools would be required to participate in the program and creates 4 categories. First is isolated districts, which are school districts with an enrollment of historically underserved students that is greater than 20% variance of an adjoining district's enrollment, so that could be 20% more or less. Second is exempt districts, which are school districts with an enrollment of historically underserved students that is between 40 and 60%. Exempt students are not considered isolated under this legislation, and they are exempt from implementing an interdistrict plan, which will be identified later. The next piece is the identifiable schools, which are schools within a school district with an enrollment in one or more
grade. Evan, baby's up.
With one or more grade levels of historically underserved students with greater than 20% variance of the student district average enrollment at the same grade level, or any school within a school district with an enrollment of historically underserved students over 80%. And then the last group of schools that would be required to participate would be identifiable charter schools, which are charter schools with an enrollment in one or more grade levels of historically underserved students with greater than 20% variance of the school district average at the same grade level in the district in which the charter school is located. Or alternatively, any charter school with an enrollment of historically underserved students over 80%. Subdivision 4, which starts on line 4.23, describes the plans that participating students' school districts must create. The plans must focus on 4 key areas. First, culturally responsive teaching. Second, student academic achievement. Third, integration. And fourth, inclusion. Plans must be adopted by the school board, which must hold at least 1 formal annual hearing to report on progress in realizing the goals in the plan. And in creating the plan, the districts must identify a leadership team, conduct a needs assessment, conduct a equity and diversity impact assessment, and identify progress processes to measure fidelity of implementation, continuous improvement monitoring, and conduct program evaluation. Paragraph D includes a list of evidence-based strategies that must be included in each plan, and districts can choose to add other strategies as they see fit. The plan must identify and increase inclusion within school buildings and must use technology or may use technology to provide integrated learning opportunities. Plans for school districts with identifiable schools must include strategies that use clear and measurable goals and timetables to eliminate the identifiable status of the schools within 3 years. Plans in these districts must also demonstrate that identifiable schools are equitably funded. Isolated districts in the 7-county metropolitan area must participate in the voluntary metro-wide integration program, which is outlined in Section 5 of this bill. Isolated districts that are outside of the 7-county metro area may participate in the voluntary metro-wide integration program. Exempt districts are not required to participate in the voluntary metro-wide integration program in Section 5, but they must allow their resident students to enroll in other districts participating in that program. The last piece of this section is Subdivision 5 on line 6.9, which includes plans for identifiable charter schools. Plans must be posted by the charter school board and approved in the same way as districts, which includes the hearing, the data collection, and posting on the website. Plans for identifiable charter schools must include marketing, lottery, and other strategies to increase the racial and socioeconomic diversity of the student body, which could include a weighted or controlled choice lottery. must also include partnerships with other school districts and charter schools designed to provide students with meaningful, integrated learning opportunities while the school works to eliminate the identifiable status. Plans must also include an equity and diversity impact assessment, must identify increasing inclusion within the school building, and include the evidence-based strategies required by for school district plans. On subdivision 6, on line 7.23, this establishes the accountability and enforcement mechanisms under this program. Participating school districts and charter schools would be submitting a detailed budget to the commissioner in the year before implementation, and the commissioner would review and approve or disapprove that budget by June 1st of that year. The department must evaluate district and charter school plans after the first year to determine whether or not they're on track to meet plan goals, and the department may conduct a second year review if it deems necessary. The school district or charter school does not meet its plan goals after 3 years, the department must complete a comprehensive evaluation of the school district or charter school's performance under the plan. The commissioner must report evaluation results to the legislature by February 1st of every odd-numbered year. School districts and charter schools that fail to meet the goals identified in their plans in the four focus areas may be subject to corrective action at the discretion of the commissioner. Identifiable schools that are state-approved alternative programs must not be subject to corrective action based solely on academic proficiency or four-year graduation rates. And charter school authorizers must evaluate performance in the program as part of the charter school's plan. And lastly, complaints alleging intentional segregation would have to be referred to the Department of Human Rights or the Office of Civil Rights of the U.S. Department of Education. Moving on to section 4, which is the revenue component of the culturally responsive teaching, learning, and integration inclusion program, on line 8.28. The first subdivision establishes the program revenue, which is $350 per historically underserved pupil in each participating district or charter school, or the greater of a 2013 hold harmless. The amount of 0.3%, I should say, of the revenue is transferred to the department for oversight and accountability of activities. For school districts, 70% of the revenue is aid and 30% is levy. For charter schools, 100% of the revenue is aid. Subdivision 4 establishes revenue uses, which says at least 75% of the revenue must be spent on culturally responsive teaching, integration, and inclusion strategies, and up to 20% of the revenue may be used for professional development, staff development activities, with no more than 10% of the total amount being spent on administrative services. On subdivision 5, starting on line 9.31, that describes revenue for exempt districts. Exempt districts, as defined above, may continue to receive revenue even when they no longer are racially isolated or have racially identifiable schools, as long as they continue to implement an approved plan. This provides resources to integrated and inclusive districts and schools so that they can continue to be integrated. Subdivision 6 creates exit revenue, which would allow other participating school districts and charter schools that meet program plan goals to continue to receive 50% of the program revenue generated in the final year of the program for an additional 3 years. This helps remove the reverse incentive that currently exists for districts to remain in the program because they risk losing funding if they meet their goals. Section 5, which starts on line 10.9, creates the voluntary metro-wide inter-district integration program. This requires the commissioner to establish a program to create pathways and incentivize voluntary inter-district enrollment that contributes to integration inclusion. This utilizes the tiered model described above, students living in tier four or five areas and participating districts transferring. They may transfer to a school in another or participating district if the school has a majority of student enrollment living in tier one or two areas. And students living in tier one or two areas and participating districts may transfer to a school in another participating school district if the majority of the receiving school's students live in tier four or five areas. Subdivision 2 explains the application approval process. The school district must apply to the commissioner for approval to participate in the program, and the application must demonstrate certain evidence-based practices. Subdivision 3 establishes funding for the program. The serving district must provide transportation and can be reimbursed for that transportation. The serving district will receive an additional 25% of the per pupil basic funding formula for each student participating in the program, and 85% of that revenue needs to be spent at the school site. The resident district from which the student goes will receive an additional 25% of the per pupil basic education revenue formula allowance for each participating student. Subdivision 4 on line 11.8 creates an accountability system, which includes MDE collecting longitudinal data on participating districts and a three-year evaluation process to ensure that districts continue to meet the eligibility criteria in Subdivision 2. Section 6, which is the creation of the diverse magnet school program, starting on line 12.3, Subdivision 1 sets definitions. Subdivision 2 directs the commissioner to establish 4 initial magnet schools designed to attract a diverse student body and excel with historically underserved students. Magnet schools must be operational and serving students by the 23-24 school year. Subdivision 3 explains the enrollment process. The magnet schools must be schools of choice, open to any student in the 7-county metro area. Any student who submits an application shall be enrolled unless they exceeds capacity, in which pupils would be accepted by lot, and school would have to create a lottery process, and cannot give preference based on certain criteria, including academic assessments or measures of achievement. The school must give enrollment preference to students residing in tier 4 or 5 areas. And a magnet school must also give enrollment preference to siblings or foster children of a parent's pupil. And a magnet school must enroll at least 40% and no more than 60% of students from tier 4 or 5 areas. Subdivision 4 creates a magnet innovation oversight board, establishes the board's membership and terms, requires the commissioner to appoint a student advisory panel, requires MDE to provide adequate staffing for the program, including an executive director position. Subdivision 5 governs the magnet school application process. The commissioner creates an application process and rubric in consultation with the board. The board identifies priority regions in the area, suggested themes, and solicits applications from the school districts. No less than 2 of the 4 magnet schools must be established within the boundaries of Minneapolis Public Schools and St. Paul Public Schools. The oversight board will complete an initial review, recommend up to 6 sites in ranked order, and the commissioner must approve 4 of those magnet school sites. The magnet applications must meet certain criteria, which are listed in numbers 1 through 6. And once an application is approved by the commissioner, the magnet school shall operate as a district-operated, site-governed school. Subdivision 6 touches on accountability and oversight for the magnets. All magnets in the program would receive annual performance reviews accompanied by the oversight board, completed by the oversight board in each of the first 4 years of operation. After the first 4 years, the oversight board would review and reauthorize magnet schools in the 5th year of operation and every 3 years after. If a review concludes that a magnet school is not meeting the performance expectations of the board and the board, in consultation with the commissioner, can issue corrective action, findings and corrective action. If the magnet school has 1 year to, the magnet school has 1 year to complete the corrective action, and if the corrective action is not satisfied, the commissioner, in consultation with the board, may revoke the authorization of the magnet school to operate. The oversight board must provide a report to the commissioner each year, and the commissioner must provide a report to the legislature each year. And that report may include a recommendation to expand funding for the program. Subdivision 7 establishes funding for the program, which includes startup grants, and the district's hosting a state-approved magnet school will receive an additional 25% of the per pupil basic formula to allow the magnet school to provide enhanced programming. 85% of that has to be spent at the school level. All other state and federal revenue follows the student to the magnet school. The district can retain an administrative fee for managing programs, and the district and site can agree to provide certain services for the site. The resident districts from which the students come from will receive an additional 25% of the per pupil basic education formula allowance for each participating student served by a magnet school district under this section. And lastly, the state must reimburse the districts for the cost of transporting students to and from the magnet schools. Section 7 quickly just directs the department to develop a repository of evidence-based strategies that focuses on limiting outcomes, focuses on improving outcomes and eliminating disparities for historically underserved students. This is a non-exclusive list of strategies that are included in the legislation in numbers 1 through 12. The section also directs the commissioner to develop and maintain a web-based state-level family information system that allows user-friendly school-by-school comparisons, as well as easy-to-understand district and statewide data in multiple languages. To the extent allowable by Chapter 13, the system must also include the ability to disaggregate student data. The section has a non-exhaustive list of data that must be included in the system, which is 1 through 15. Section 8 is the appropriation section, and Section 9 is the repealer of the existing Achievement Integration Program and Revenue Statutes, as well as the current Desegregation and Integration Rule. So that completes the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to stop and take any questions that folks have.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy, and members. And Mr. Cordy, my apologies for the interruption there briefly. Members, any questions for Mr. Cordy at this time? Okay, I'm not seeing any on my screen. At this time, I do just want to note that Representative Richardson and Representative Feist have joined us. And also, it looks like Representative Thompson. So welcome to those members. And we will continue with our testifiers today. Up next is Dan Schulman, lead counsel for the Cruz Guzman versus the state of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you and good afternoon, members of the committee. I am Dan Schulman and I am a lawyer and I am the lead lawyer in the Cruz Guzman case. Now, I brought the Cruz Guzman case in 2015. And I brought it to try to solve two apparently intractable and undeniably interrelated problems. One was and continues to be segregation by race and socioeconomic status in the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts, the traditional school districts. The second is the achievement gap, where students of color, students who are economically deprived and disadvantaged, continue to lag behind more affluent white students, or it doesn't matter what race they are, they're affluent. And this is a problem that both problems have persisted for years, despite all efforts to try to solve those problems. My objective was not so much to win a lawsuit as to try to find a solution to problems that everyone knows exists. And I think after 2 years of mediation, we have presented you with something that I think is a truly wonderful piece of legislation. Of course, you'll be the judges of that, that will go a long way toward solving these problems. We had 2 years of mediation. I don't view that as everybody giving something up. To the contrary, I think everybody recognized and acknowledged what the problems were and looked for creative solutions. And with the help of not just the parties, but all stakeholders, charter schools, school superintendents, teachers unions, and also with the help of experts, not just here, but from all over the country. And we have two of those experts here today who will talk after I do. One is Scott Thomas, who is a Minnesotan here and has extensive experience and success with magnet schools. And the other is Rucker Johnson, also a Minnesotan, although not at the moment. He's a professor at Berkeley, and he is the foremost authority in the United States on integration and its benefits. So I brought the lawsuit. In the course of the lawsuit, there were two very significant developments from my standpoint. The first was the Supreme Court decision in 2018. And they made one statement in that decision, which nobody else has ever said, no other court has ever said. And that is, it is, quote, I'm quoting, "It is self-evident that a segregated system of public schools is not general, uniform, thorough, or efficient." Now, general, uniform, thorough, and efficient are the four words of the Minnesota Education Clause, which has put the mandate on the legislature to create and maintain schools that are general, uniform, thorough, and efficient. The second significant ruling was in 2019, and this was by the court in Hennepin County, where she found that actions taken by the legislature and the Department of Education more than 20 years ago created a system that has resulted in the segregation, the school segregation we're still living with, and that this was done with knowledge of the consequences that would result, so it could be called intentional action by the state. Now, fortunately for me, very fortunately for me and for the kids, the clients I represent, we had lawyers and parties on the other side that were willing to acknowledge the problems and wanted to fix them and had the same interests we did. And so that was resulted in the 2 years of mediation that you've heard of. And that was extensive work by everyone involved, and it produced the bill you have in front of you. Now, let me say a few things about the bill. There are two primary devices, practices, things in that bill for achieving our objectives to correct segregation and also the achievement gap. The first is intra-district and inter-district, within districts and between districts, integration. And the second is magnet schools, which have been proven elsewhere in the country. And in particular, because one of our experts was the person who did it in San Antonio, Texas. And you've heard about how it's possible to classify the entire state according to census tiers 1 to 5 in terms of being economically advantaged or disadvantaged. This was first done in San Antonio, Texas, and has now been done for the entire state of Texas. So this is something that both blue and red states can use to their great benefit. Now, there are two very important things I want to say about the bill and about the two things that we've put in place, that we'd ask you to put in place, the integration program and the magnet schools. The first is that parent choice is respected. There is no, under this bill, no parent is compelled to send a child where the parent chooses not to do so. Parent choice is respected. The only constraint, which is a constraint that exists today, is on school capacity. In other words, the school must have the places to take the child. The second important aspect of this bill and our solution is that no student is given a preference based on race. The only criteria for preferences is economic disadvantage. And that, of course, that's important because there's other scholarship, and I think Rucker Johnson has confirmed this, that one of the outstanding correlatives of failure to succeed in school is poverty. And obviously the wealth gaps in this country and in this state between black and white are enormous. And so this is a permissible way under the law of dealing with this problem. The preferences will be based on socioeconomic status. Nobody gets a preference because of skin color. Now, we think this bill will make a start and a good start. And we hope, we had four objectives coming into this mediation. They were integration, achievement, equity, and opportunity. We would not have, this bill wouldn't be in front of you unless we felt all of those interests were served in this bill. We also wanted two other things in order to make this bill effective. One is public buy-in. And I think what I've told you about the bill, I hope will secure the public buy-in that we think this bill deserves. And the second is we want a solution that is enduring. We want longevity. We don't want something that is today's today's miracle cure and it's gone tomorrow. We want something that is there for the long haul and that it progress, it's not going to happen overnight. We know that, but we think it can happen under this. So if you have questions for me, I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, I'd like to turn this over. Oh, by the way, one other thing. I know that the executive directors of the three charter schools that intervened in the case will be speaking. They were active, good faith participants in this mediation, and I have learned and I have the utmost respect for all three of them. So I want you to know that before you hear them speak. So unless you have questions for me, I will turn this over now to Scott Thomas to tell you about his experience with magnet schools.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Thomas. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Scott Thomas, and I'm employed by the Northeast Metro School District 916. And it's a pleasure to speak with you today and share information about the proposal as it relates to magnet schools, and specifically Section 6. And my speaking today is not affiliated with 916 and is voluntary. And the reason I was asked to speak today, as Dan mentioned, is my experience with magnet schools is fairly unique and vast. And I started my work in relation to magnet schools in the Rosemount Apple Valley Eagan School District, where I was responsible for implementing the district's integration and educational equity plan. As part of an overall plan, required us to explore magnet schools as one option to help integrate our segregated schools. Through my work there, we designed schools with our families, with teachers, and those most impacted by the opportunity, including community stakeholders like businesses, city government, and nonprofits. We designed these schools based on the assets within the schools, including their diversity, as well as local assets, including parks, arts groups, STEM industries, and higher education to develop themes and training. Today, the initial three magnet schools we developed are nationally recognized and high achieving, with Glacier Hills School of Arts and Science, where I was principal, becoming Minnesota's first nationally certified demonstration magnet school because it met model criteria for achievement, diversity, theme integration, community and family engagement, and decision-making. We also showed that students who live within the attendance zone benefited most academically from those magnet themes, which was a key criteria for success. I went on to serve as the executive director of Magnet Schools of America. And during my tenure there, we created for the first time national standards of excellence and named the ideal conditions for high quality and sustainable magnet programs. I also had the opportunity to evaluate district magnet programs, convene national conferences and training related to magnet schools, led a research committee, and personally visited over 100 magnet schools. And I've collaborated and advised on regional approaches to magnet schools and in large districts that serve large and diverse populations of students. I should also mention, as some of you might find me familiar, is that I was co-chair of the Integration Revenue Task Force 9 years ago, and that led to the Achievement and Integration Program. Through my experiences as a creator, national director, and as principal of two award-winning magnet schools, I have a unique perspective on the efficacy of magnet schools, and I'm also engaged in the research around the efficacy of magnets and happy to share some of that with you today. We have seen in communities large and small that when magnet schools are done well through policy, design, magnet schools are one effective mechanism of achieving meaningful school diversity and opportunity through choice. We see successful, publicly popular magnet options all over the country. But magnet schools are not a monolith. Just as charter schools should not be painted with a broad brush, magnet schools sometimes have different aims and goals. And while some programs are attended to with great care, others are not, and actually create inequity in a community. We don't aspire to create inequity, but to expand access to quality and opportunity. So we know what works and we know what does not. What this proposal does is based on using some of the best practices on the policy side to create the conditions for meaningful diversity, equity, achievement, and opportunity. What this proposal does specifically is it requires districts to engage with their communities in a different way, with families, students, and stakeholders to design academic offerings that are interesting and provide incredible opportunities to students they serve directly, as well as those within the districts they attend when they are well-designed. This proposal brings together critical stakeholders through an independent oversight board. It gives a level of autonomy to the school without the red tape, politics, while still having clear accountability measures. This model does not cream the top and use scarcity of student-driven revenue, as some programs do, but rather provides access without testing and rewards school districts with revenue so funding can be steady and predictable. This proposal does not ask for dozens of magnet schools across the region. In fact, I would argue that this proposal does not go far enough or develop enough magnet schools. But what you're seeing here is not an original idea. In fact, as was mentioned earlier, Texas has used a similar model, specifically looking at San Antonio, as a model of how school districts are partnering with stakeholders to create really innovative programs and opportunities for students that are leading to increased achievement, access to post-secondary institutions, and career training. In a recent meta-analysis of research, Dr. Zhao Wang from California and her colleagues found 7 studies that looked at magnet school achievements of students who were selected through random lottery. And this study is especially important because it is the best available way to limit selection bias. And in her meta-analysis, she found that 5 of the 7 studies showed statistically significant positive impact of magnet schools on math achievement, while no studies found that magnet schools negatively impacted student achievement. A Connecticut study found that magnet schools have a positive effect on math and reading achievement for high school students, and positive effects on reading achievement for middle school students. The researchers also found that magnet schools provide students with more integrated peer environments. The other 2 studies did not show academic achievement. However, these studies showed positive benefits for magnet school attendees on learning outcomes related to their achievement. Specifically, among students categorized as high risk, the researchers observed that those who attended magnet schools earned more credits towards graduation, had better attendance, and were more likely to compete in core academic courses and had lower dropout rates. Likewise, researchers observed enrollees had lower self-reported disciplinary incidents and arrest rates. In a California study, researchers observed students enrolled in magnet middle schools and magnet high schools were substantially more likely to graduate on time than their peers who attended traditional schools. The authors attribute the stark difference in greater college-going resources, student body racial and ethnic diversity, and greater levels of academic engagement in magnet schools resulting from students having the opportunity to choose a theme that aligned to their learning interests. So overall, 12 studies showed positive effects, with half of those showing statistically significant positive results. We know that the research is there, and we know what makes for high quality magnet schools that create meaningful diversity, create access to opportunity where it did not and does not exist. We know that magnet schools raise the tide of all ships when they're created as incubators of innovation. And magnet schools cannot be viewed as the silver bullet or a panacea to address racial disparities in achievement, racial and socioeconomic aggression, but they're the best option when used with other strategies to create reform. I'd point to Miami-Dade County, where they have used the magnet approach to transform their district. They believe that every student has gifts, talent, and unique interests, and that schools should be designed around what students want and need to achieve their goals. As a result, they have increased enrollment, reduced dropout rates, increased graduation and post-secondary training and college enrollment. I visited one program where students learned how to weld underwater, an increasingly important skill for the energy sector in the Miami-Dade area, and students graduate able to earn more than $80,000. Miami is also known for the arts, fashion, and design, so they develop schools with industry advisory boards to ensure students have access to industry standard equipment, and that equipment is provided by its partners. In Minnesota, we have the opportunity to develop more world-class high schools that intentionally connect to our thriving STEM sectors, arts sectors, and agricultural sector, which has deep roots in our state history.
Mr. Thomas, at this point, I'm going to need you to wrap it up.
Thank you. Well, in closing, this proposal is not like Connecticut, not like Texas or Miami, and not like anywhere else. But it takes the best approaches we've learned over the past 50 years magnet schools have been in existence. With nearly 4,000 magnet schools nationwide serving 3.5 million students, we know a thing or two about what makes them work. We have nearly 100 magnet schools in Minnesota alone. However, few are middle school or high school. We have a need and we have an opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Rucker Johnson. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Sarah, do we know if Dr. Johnson is with us?
He's here.
Can you hear me? This is Rucker Johnson from UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for your time. I want to thank you for this opportunity. I'm going to begin with a quote. Arthur Chan once said, "Diversity is a fact. Equity is a choice. Inclusion is an action. Belonging is an outcome." What we're adding to that today is policy, is the bridge that connects resources and opportunity to make it happen for today's children. And the reality, living reality for millions of children, however, is quite different. And segregation as a means of courting opportunity is the culprit. School segregation and unequal school resources are the nerve center of inequitable educational opportunity that perpetuates structural racism. Now, what we're trying to identify is this moment of this bill and this passage of legislation is building on a strong research base of what worked and what are the legacy of segregation that this is to overcome. And because there's a lot of policy amnesia in this space about what works, why it works, and how it works, it's important to understand the interconnections of how the prevailing high levels of segregation undermine equal educational opportunity, are the single biggest driver of racial differences in upward mobility prospects for children, make the nation less productive and competitive, and weaken our economy. And what we're trying to identify is the solution set that can help us break this cycle, that has a generational component to address the issues. And when we talk about integration, right, we're not just talking about the ways in which it affects achievement and then access to higher education and then labor market disparities and then fills into adult economic status and well-being. And the cycle continues and spills over into disparities in criminal justice environment and the like. But what we recognize is to break that, we need a set of policy tools that identify. And that when we're talking about integration, it's not only about the assignments of children to schools by race, but centrally about equitable school resources. That's funding, teacher quality, teacher diversity, curricular quality, and moving from speed segregation to integration means moving from access to inclusion. It's moving from exposure to understanding. And when we are able to do that in a holistic way, we're able to do things that create systems of opportunity that reverberate across generations. Now, what I'm going to be focusing on today is a recognition that the contemporary policy and sources of school segregation are that some of the resegregation that we've witnessed has been in other state systems. Unregulated charter school growth has been shown to exacerbate school segregation without a proven track record of consistently improving access to high quality schools for poor and low income families. There's gerrymandered school boundaries that are happening all over the country. There's racialized tracking. There's the legacy and zoning policies and exclusionary zoning policies and the ways in which our housing subsidies have concentrated poverty. And certainly real estate and mortgage lending practices. There's a lot of components that build on a legacy of past policies. And that's why it's so critical that we reconsider the prior evidence. That when we look at the black-white test score gap among students born in 1954 compared to those born 30 years later, and notice that it declined by nearly 40%. That narrowing of that achievement gap of 40%, and then no further progress in closing the black-white test score gap since the 80s, or at least a significant part, a big chunk of that is due to our investment and commitment to integration that, while short-lived, reaped significant benefits that I'm going to highlight here. Now, in order to appreciate that, you have to consider the timing of when real integration occurred. And this map just shows you that in the first decade after Brown, there was limited integration efforts until the 64 Civil Rights Act put teeth in enforcement. And there was a great acceleration where we reached integration levels in 1988. And then in districts across the country, we saw a resegregation of schools begin in the early 90s through the 2000s. And what we're documenting is the timing of those integration efforts that led directly to the reduction and racial school segregation and more integration along socioeconomic status lines. And a big part of that operated through increases in access to school resources. That is, we saw about a 20% increase in per pupil spending for Black children after the court order, and significant reductions in class size where the resources were leveled up to the level whites were previously receiving. And we saw that this translated directly into gains for Black children that did not come at the expense of white children. And the effect of attending integrated schools for all K through 12 years was large enough to eliminate the Black-white educational gap. And that's what you see here. And what we are able to show by looking at children from the same schools before and after the exposure to integration, we see a dose response that earnings in adulthood increased on the order of 30% for children from the same schools, but who were exposed throughout their school age years versus children from those schools prior to those integration efforts, again, with no negative impacts for whites, and significant reductions in the annual incidence of poverty. With a dose response, with each additional year of exposure to integrated schools, we saw a significant reduction in the likelihood of being poor in adulthood. And these were transformative and translated also to reductions in the likelihood of ever being incarcerated for Black children in particular that were exposed to integrated schools. Now, the point is that these impacts of integration were not felt only for the first generation that attended desegregated schools, but for their children as well. And yet, a part of that mechanism was via per pupil spending increases, where we saw and see for our contemporary cohorts that per pupil spending really improves math achievement across all grades. Now, fast forward to where we are today, the lifting of the release of court orders did significantly hamper some of these gains. And we saw, following the end of court order desegregation 3 decades ago, school segregation rose substantially. A return to neighborhood schools nationwide, 42% of Latino students and 40% of Black students attend schools where less than 10% of their peers are white. What we're talking about is the three-dimensional synergy between school integration, school funding reforms, and quality pre-K, and part of this importance of the ways in which magnet schools can be a part of that solution. Now, this is the contemporary view of what we're talking about in gaps of learning rates between white and black students, and I'm coming to my close because I know time is of the essence. I want you to see that this scatter plot, every circle represents a school district, and this, every district in the United States is represented on this figure. On the x-axis is white students' learning rates, and on the y-axis is black students' learning rates. And in red is the Minneapolis Public School District. And what I want you to see is it shows that relative to the nation average, white students in Minneapolis Public Schools' learning rates are 17.6% greater than the national average, but black students' learning rates, growth rates in a given year, are 6.1% the nation average. And part of that gap in learning rates accumulates over the school career, hamper college preparation aspirations, and a part of that is the segregated aspect of schooling in our schools. Now, part of this is not just about educational outcomes that are more easily measurable, but as Martin King said, people fail to get along because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they have not communicated with each other. What we're able to also document is how exposure to diverse schools influences, thank you, I had to hear the 1 minute, I'm in my clothes, impacts the actual racial attitudes and political attitudes expressed in adulthood. So we're able to follow longitudinally children from the same schools before and after the resegregation of schools. And we find our results show that the confinement to segregated, poorly funded schools interferes with children's life chances. But not only that, but children in these schools struggle to develop the ability to empathize with others, to appreciate the validity of other cultures, and to experience the art of thinking individually together, as diversity has been aptly described. But we're able to kind of document that. I need to wrap up. We show how resegregation of schools have resulted in lower educational attainment for poor minority children, widened academic achievement gaps. A big part of that is the way in which teacher quality has been negatively affected. We see that the recent surges in political polarization and racial intolerance in adulthood are linked to the lack of school-based exposure to diversity. This is a moment in Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul Public Schools to reverse this trend with the evidence base to demonstrate targeted public investments from pre-K through 12 and help more than pay for themselves down the road, as we document in the ways of communities spending less on remediation, less on public assistance, less on crime, while benefiting from children reaching their full potential. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Johnson. Members, are there questions at this time? Sarah, okay. Not seeing any hands raised, we will continue on. Next, we have Dr. Chavez Russell, the Executive Director with Friendship Academy of the Arts, Minneapolis. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Dr. Chavez Russell. I'm the Executive Director of Friendship Academy of the Arts, and it's such a pleasure to be here today before the committee. Friendship Academy of the Arts is in its 20th year. We are a kindergarten through eighth grade charter school that recently expanded to a new campus this year to serve more families. We are 96% African-American, 80% free and reduced lunch. And I would say we're the only blue ribbon school in Minneapolis right now that we obtained in 2016. So, and I have appreciated the time that we have had during mediation, really uplifting, giving us an opportunity to share what's been working, all the three schools for us. And I'm glad to see some of those things, a lot of those things that are in this bill. So it gives me hope and that we, through continued conversation, will be able to create a plan together that would close this achievement gap and give provide the education that our students deserve. And some of those things that jump out at me is the culturally responsive teaching. Those strategies, such as restorative practices, the focus on accountability is something that we talked a lot about. And the evidence, section 7, where it says the evidence-based strategies and family information system, those are things that we think is what it takes to educate the child that comes that gives you the opportunity to educate them. And that is how we view it at Friendship Academy, because through the current charter law, similar to what's presented in this bill, there are no restrictions other than capacity and space. So what that means for us is we don't have any control over who comes through our doors, that who sees us in a light where they want to give us the opportunity to educate their children. But once they do come through those doors, we adjust accordingly. We adjust our approach accordingly so that we are culturally affirming, affirm them in who they are, regardless of what culture they're from, and understand how that interacts with other cultures as well. At Friendship, we are preparing for a more diverse student body as we continue to grow. And we know that we don't have any control over that. And we welcome that diverse environment to where we can utilize these strategies. This is some of the strategies that we utilize in order to be successful, in order to provide an equitable education to every child that walks through our doors. And with that, there also are some challenges that we fundamentally that we've been discussing throughout this process, specifically in section 3, where it mentions the integration and inclusion program. That particular piece of it, we feel that will limit parent choice. I know I respect Mr. Shulman and all the work that he's done, and I had a pleasure of getting to know him better, but we feel like this will limit parent choice and significantly disrupt the charter sector in general, and really divert our attention away from what really matters, what really going to make the difference, and that is building relationships, getting to know our students, understanding how they learn, and then adjusting accordingly, so they see themselves as being successful, and it's not based on how much money they make or anything like that, but it's based on what we know and the confidence and the belief that they have in themselves. So we want to continue to hope we can continue to have this dialogue, but we are glad that a lot of things that we are discussed are in this bill. So with that being said, I want to pass it to my colleague, Brandon Waite.
Thank you, Dr. Russell. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Waite. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, everyone. My name is Brandon Waite. I'm the executive director of Paladin Career and Technical High School, and we're one of the defendant intervenors schools. Paladin is a public charter school located in Blaine. We are a 9 through 12 plus public charter school that serves almost 200 students. Our students choose to come to us from over 200 square mile radius, with some of our students traveling on the Metro Transit system for up to 1.5 hours, one way to attend our school. I feel that says a lot about our students, their resilience, and a little bit about Paladin. As a side note, our diversity makeup of our school is around 60% students of color, 40% white, and around 80% free and reduced lunch. First off, thank you, Mr. Dabney, and members of the committee for the opportunity to share our thoughts, raise questions and or concerns. And Mr. Shulman, it's good. It's been too long. It's good to see you. I'd like to reiterate some of Dr. Russell mentioned. At 3,000 feet view, there's a lot in here that both myself and our fellow charter school leaders can agree on. Equity, diversity, raising academics, closing the achievement gap, of course we support. In fact, we can really get behind the evidence-based practices that are listed in line item 5.12, the strategies such as culturally responsive teaching, recruitment of retention of culturally competent teachers, equitable non-exclusionary disciplinary practices, restorative practices are dear to my heart, social emotional learning, student engagement, dropout prevention strategies. In fact, we strongly think that all schools should implement these evidence-based practices. The irony in this bill, which calls for creating a plan for an identifiable school, is that we are leaders in these evidence-based practice strategies. And by this definition, we would also be an identifiable school. The irony is that we are the ones leading the trainings to other schools on such evidence-based practices. What the bill doesn't define is the importance of culturally affirming schools. We would love this definition and the empowerment in place with historically underserved populations. My two colleagues would be excellent resources to help with this definition as they embody school communities as well. I would like to follow up on, due to time, there's a question I'm going to go back to under 4.8, identifiable charter schools. So we would be identified under this. And my question is, does the definition of what identifiable charter school account for public schools that are mainly white in historically underserved communities, or is this bill just for schools that serve a high number of students of color, indigenous students, and are students of poverty? Also, if you are labeled as an identifiable school, you have 3 years to eliminate the identifiable status. This does not seem to be clearly defined in the bill. Under 6.1, it talks about this and the need to eliminate the identifiable status in 3 years. So my question is, because our families choose to come to us, who happen to be students of color in free reduced lunch, how do we eliminate parental school choice? And are we okay with removing this right of public choice for Minnesotans? I could be wrong, but the way I read this, the only way for our schools and schools like us to not be identified because of parental choice would be to recruit families with different backgrounds, which would mean for me and many of my colleagues, recruiting students with higher incomes and who are white. In connection with that, there are plans for identified charter schools under 6.1, the lottery system. A charter school may devise a weighted lottery choice lottery to use other enrollment strategies that would increase the diversity of the student body. So here's
a couple. Mr. Waite, I need you to wrap it up at this point.
Okay. So the question around the lottery system, is this just for the identified schools to increase diversity? Or what about the schools that are all white? Would they be required to have weighted or controlled choice to bring in diversity to their schools? Or already culturally affirming or identified school? Are we then saying we need to put weights on students that do not fall under historically underserved populations?
I think. Thank you so much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Yigza. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Mr. Yigza, I think you're muted.
Sorry. Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. I am Samuel Yigza. I'm the director of Higher Ground Academy. I'd like to thank Chair Devaney for the opportunity to participate in this informational hearing. We appreciate this as a place for continuing the dialogue. We support most things in this bill. Allow me to share a story. In the spring of 2020, we made outreach to families in our neighborhood, which is diverse. Our staff, which is highly diverse too, went door to door to all homes in the neighborhood and met the neighbors, passed out promotional materials, and let them know that HGA, Higher Ground Academy, is a school for everyone. We also put together a carnival and invited our neighbors to come and meet and learn about us. Unfortunately, that did not yield a single applicant from the neighborhood. On the other hand, that same year, we received more than 150 applications for grades K through 12 from the current constituent, which is above 90% on free and reduced lunch, 99% students of color. I'm giving you this example to make a point that the population we are serving chose us. We did not choose our students. This was true 21 years ago, and it's still true today. Bill Wilson started Higher Ground Academy to be a school for all disadvantaged students who choose to be at Higher Ground Academy. Unfortunately, we did not happen to be the public school of choice for some, but we are for others. And we are serving those who chose us very well, doing all the things in this bill, such as equity, culturally responsive teaching, positive behavioral intervention, and more. When I read this bill, specifically the parts about identifiability, I felt like some elements will be unfair to us and others like us. It seems to me that there is a belief that we are intentionally exclusive. We are not. We are only respecting the parents' public school choice. On a different point, it would be helpful to know how the multi-tiered system in Section 2, Part A, lines 13.3 to 13.6, play into the identifiability of schools. Finally, I want to say, if one was to conduct a study among our graduates and ask them the kinds of questions in the studies Mr. Thomas cited, I guarantee you that you will find the same results from our graduates. Our graduates are succeeding and they are happy. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Yigza. Members, are there any questions at this time for the school interveners or any of the other presenters? Rep. Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had actually a few quick clarifying questions just so I could understand the bill a little bit better. Is Mr. Cordy still on?
Yes, I'm here.
He is. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. Could you tell me a little bit more about what the responsibilities will be for exempt districts that are between the 40 and 60%?
Sure.
Mr. Cordy.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Joachim. In the bill, you'll see that there's a number of things that all districts are required to do under the plan. I lost the bill here, closed the wrong window, but I will find the line and number for you here in a second. But basically, the concept was that all districts that or charter schools that fall into this program should be able to participate in the program, receive the revenue, and use some of these evidence-based practices. However, there were the pieces around inter-district integration that would also need to take place under the culturally responsive teaching and integration inclusion program. So the exempt districts, if you look at line 4.9, explains that if a district is between 40 and 60%, that they are not considered isolated and don't have to comply with the portion of the section which has to do about the inter-district plan. And I can find the other piece here for you quickly as well.
So the maybe I'll just cut to the chase. Madam Chair, sure. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted. Madam Chair.
Rep. Joachim.
Thank you. I know there's other people that probably want to ask questions, and I have a few others. I'm just a little concerned because I want to thank Chancellor Johnson for mentioning early childhood education being such a huge key to success. I'm a big fan. And thank Dr. Russell for pointing out the importance of all the items in Section 7 in making sure students are successful. I'm wondering the 40 to 60% schools, which I think I'm representing both of mine fall in that category. We still struggle with an opportunity gap and still have a lot of work to do and still need to be doing all the things that are in Section 7. So I'm worried that some schools that are considered exempt when they still have work to do for all of our kids are kind of going to be like left off the hook. So I was just wondering what are going to, you know, if they're still going to be required to do a lot of the things in Section 7 as they should be.
Right, yeah.
Mr. Cordy, briefly.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Joachim. Yes, if you look at line 5.12, there's a list of evidence-based strategies there that would be in all plans for districts, whether or not they were isolated or exempt. So these were the things that we thought all districts in this program should be doing and should receive money to do. The only difference is that the exempt districts don't have to do the pieces that follow around the plan for inclusion and participation in the voluntary inter-district integration transportation program. And the thought there was being that if you have a school that's at 40 to 60%, that school is probably considered integrated in the eyes of most folks. And so we want to make sure that you have the resources to do the evidence-based practices, but not necessarily requiring them to do the inter-district piece because you don't want to disrupt the current integrative state of that district.
Thank you. Representative Joachim, I know you said you had extra questions. If it's okay with you, I'm going to move on. We have one more question from Representative Jordan, and we need to allow a couple of minutes for wrap-up. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, like Representative Joachim, have a lot of questions, but I guess the first one that comes to mind is this question around parent choice. And I guess I'm wondering, does this bill limit our current open enrollment system? We have a lot of, I know in my district, I have some of my more upper income families, and those tend to be wider families, leave for other wider, wealthier districts. So how, and at all, would this bill impact their ability to move and vote with their feet? And so I guess I think that's a pretty big concern of mine. And how can districts meet their integration requirements if families are, in essence, opting out of this integration plan put forth by districts?
I'm not sure if this is a question for Mr. Cordy, but I'm going to send it to you first.
I think maybe Commissioner Cordy or whoever can answer, but I bet Darren's maybe the best.
Sure. Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Jordan. Yes, so this would not change the current integrated or open enrollment system that we have. That would still be an option for families to take advantage of. However, the additional funding revenue that is generated in this bill for the voluntary inter-district integration transfer program, those students wouldn't likely generate in the situation you were talking about, whether you have an affluent family moving from a non-affluent neighborhood to a district that is more affluent, that would likely just be your traditional open enrollment. It wouldn't be part of this new program that we're talking about here. So I do not think it would limit choices for those families.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is then is how are we taking that, if families are opting not to integrate, how are we taking that into account as we're creating these integration plans, and how are districts going to be able to plan around that, if at all?
Mr. Cordy.
Sure. There's a lot of different pieces in the bill, besides just moving families that work toward integration. Integration is one piece of this program. And so I think that we're emphasizing throughout the larger plan, that there's a lot of things that districts can be doing to move toward you're making progress toward not being isolated anymore, not having schools that are identifiable, but there's a lot more pieces that are going on in the bill that would hopefully, create a situation in that district where they're being able to offer programming to families that's attractive and keep them in the districts rather than, wanting to look elsewhere.
Thank you very much. Members, I've just received notice that we have been allotted 10 extra minutes. We will have to have a hard stop at 4:40, but this does allow us a few more moments for questions. A follow-up, Representative Jordan?
I have more questions on a different topic, Madam Chair. I'll allow other members to ask questions, but if no one has any, I have other ones.
Very good. I know Representative Joachim had some follow-up. I do want to make sure other members have an opportunity if they have questions. I'm looking for hands, and I don't see any at this time. Rep Joachim?
Yes, maybe I can roll two of them into one. One, I appreciated the MDE's report on after the first 2 years of the Choice Is Yours program. It'd be nice to see if there were follow-up reports. I think would have been a lot more beneficial as well. And then maybe a question quickly for Mr. Shulman. And I know you guys have mentioned with this bill magnet schools, and I'm just still trying to figure out how it's any different from our West Metro education program and some of the integrated schools we've tried in the past that didn't really work out as well as they probably should have. And wondering how a second iteration of it would change. I mean, our districts have changed since 2000, since that last lawsuit, but wondering what your thoughts are.
Mr. Shulman.
Yes. Well, we've tried to structure it differently so that it has the basically the Department of Education involved in it. And we've also tried to make the financial incentives more attractive so that it works. And the control over it, unlike the other programs in the past that have failed, the control is really centralized with the commissioner and the executive director. So I think the structure of it is designed to avoid these problems. You mentioned the Choice is Yours program. The Choice is Yours program is the result of the first desegregation case I filed in 1995, which we hope would be a first step to meaningful integration and desegregation, and unfortunately wasn't. So, which is why I filed this one.
Follow-up, Rep. Joachim.
No, I'll let Representative Jordan do her follow-up. I can always take some more questions offline.
Very good. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question also relates to students who are highly mobile. Especially as it relates to Section 5. We have schools, especially some of my district, that have higher concentrations of students who are experiencing homelessness or have families that have experienced trauma. And I'm wondering how that is, that will impact those families' ability to opt into some of the services and provisions under Section 5. I think this is a really critically important section of the bill, and I'm happy to see its inclusion, but I'm wondering how we'll make sure that students who are in most need of these services will be able to access all the programs that we outline here.
Assistant Commissioner Cordy maybe can take that one.
Thank you. Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Jordan. Yeah, so if you go back to the section on the bill that has to do Section 2 around how we create this tiered identification system, all students who are homeless would automatically be considered Tier 5 under that system, which means that's the most challenging tier, and basically would give those families access to be able to transfer to participating districts that offer different programming and that were perhaps in a less challenging environment. So they are prioritized in that Section 5.
Follow up?
No, Madam Chair, not at this time. Let me hear other members.
Okay, are there any other member questions? I am not seeing any. And so with that, I'm sorry, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question, but just I wanted to comment to Mr. Johnson that your PowerPoint is amazing. And it was in our materials, and I have saved it for future reference and use in making points. I really appreciated that data, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Rep. Joachim.
Thank you. If we do have time, I just one more clarifying question around the integration aid. It looks like it's being expanded and hopefully more money is being put into it because our schools do need the help. Mr. Cordy, maybe you could explain it to me. I'm still trying to wrap my head. I know we don't have a fiscal note yet, but the integration aid is being used in some districts, probably should be utilized even more. How is this just moving money around, or is it actually getting some more funds to the schools to do the work that they need to do?
Mr. Cordy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Joachim. Yes, this is additional revenue on top of what's already in the program right now. So the two big changes are the inclusion of students in poverty as a generator of revenue. So if you have districts that are currently in the program, if they have any white students who are in poverty, those students would now start to generate revenue under this program, whereas they hadn't before. And then the other piece that adds additional revenue is, of course, the addition of charter schools and the revenue that they would, additional revenue they would receive to operate this program. We are still kind of trying to work through what the maps would look like in terms of demographics by adding students in poverty as a measure. We know that there would be some more traditional districts that would be identified outside of the metro area that would be eligible to or required to participate in the program and receive revenue that hadn't in the past. In general, districts that are already in the program will get more revenue. Charter schools that enter the program will get all the revenue that districts get, and then new districts coming in will get additional revenue as well. So it won't be a loss of revenue for anyone.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. I am going to turn this over to Chair Dabney. I do know that there is just one more question possibly, but I do want to allow enough time for you to make closing comments. We have 4 minutes remaining. Do you feel there's time for one more question?
Why don't we take one more question, Madam Chair?
Okay, as briefly as we can. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question might be better addressed offline, and I'll follow up with folks individually.
Very good. Thank you so much. Representative Dabney, with that, I will turn it over to you for closing comments.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for handling the chair duties again today. I much appreciate that. Thank you to all the testifiers. Members, this is a significant piece of legislation that I think we all need to spend a little time sinking our teeth into. I appreciate the members that asked questions to try to further explore the different provisions and their significance. Thank you again to the testifiers who took time out of their day to present today. With that, Madam Chair, back to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Members, seeing no other questions and having wrapped up with our final remarks, I too just want to thank you and thank all of the testifiers for the work today. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.